Well, we're going to start, and what I would like to do, we have a bunch of new members on this committee, so if we go around the table and just introduce ourselves, tell each other where you're from, and so I will start. I am Tom Huntley. I'm the chair of this committee, and I represent a district in the eastern part of Duluth, and we'll... You're next.
Dan Horner, and I work for Representative Huntley. I'm the committee legislative assistant for this committee.
Hi, Jim Abler from Anoka in the city of Ramsey. I'm just glad to be back. It's quite an interim. I'm Larry Hodge. I represent District 14B, which is in central Minnesota, including the cities of St. Joseph, down to Painesville, and Clearwater.
And I'm Maria Rood, and I represent 42A, which is southern Minnetonka and northern Eden Prairie, and it's good to be back on this committee.
I'm Representative Patty Fritz, and I represent parts of Rice and Steele County. I live in Faribault, Minnesota, and I'm also glad to be back. See everybody.
I'm Tom Anzels. I have the Western Iron Range all the way to the Canadian border, Lake of the Woods. Glad to be here.
My name is Emily Cleveland. I'm with the House Research Department. I cover health department programs.
Sam Pollock, DFL Research for Health and Human Services.
Dan Holcomb, CA, for the committee.
I'm Laura Broad. I represent District 25A, which includes all of Lasura County, east half of Sibley, a little bit of Scott, and that is located 40 miles southwest of Minneapolis.
Tom Emmer, the eastern half of Wright County.
Some of Hennepin County. Matt Dean, Northern Washington.
Hi, I'm Lynn Ace from House Research. I handle human services and chemical dependency and mental health.
Randy Chun with House Research. I cover state health care programs, nursing home reimbursements, and health care reform.
Linda Boudreau, Republican Caucus Research.
Let me point out, you've all received a folder that just has a bunch of information that you should take with you in it, and it has some useful things like what all the acronyms mean. This committee has more acronyms used to describe things. I always like to tell people that I was on this committee for 4 years before I figured out there was a Department of Health and a Department of Human Services. So it's very complex, and I would urge you to browse through that folder and keep it in your office. And let's see what else. Oh, we have set up some informational hearings, and we did it in a way that can be free from the press, to be honest. And the idea was that you could meet with staff and ask them questions that you might not want to ask in a public meeting. But we need to know if people are going to show up for those, because if you're not, we don't want to have the department staff come over and meet separately with these groups if nobody's going to show up. So please let us know if you're going to attend those meetings or not attend them. I'll survey people. Yeah, okay. And with that, I think today we're going to try to get a budget overview of the Department of Human Services, which is, 25-26% of the state budget. And for those that are new, Mr. Anzelk, anyway, the Department of Human Services is much larger than the Department of Health. So with that, I'll turn it over to the Deputy Commissioner Christine Bronson, who used to be a staff person on this committee with Kevin Goodnow.
I did.
A few years ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Christine Bronson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services, and only the Department of Human Services. It's good to be with you and back for a 2009 legislative session. Chairman Huntley asked that DHS spend the early part of this afternoon orienting you to the agency's budget. as a cornerstone for your work during session. Some of you are veterans at this, and you've been around long enough to know things that I'm going to cover today. So today's presentation may be a bit of review, though if you're feeling rusty after interim, it might be a good refresher. We designed our discussion today to focus on those of you who are new to the legislature, either this term or last term, and to those of you who may be longtime legislators but new to this committee assignment. My goal for this afternoon will be to outline for you the broad landscape of the agency's budget at its most macro level. My intent is to convey to you the scaffolding of the state human services budget environment so that you have an understanding of the big parameters, drivers, and cost trends as you work on discrete individual pieces of human services policy within that scaffolding. I will give brief summaries of programs during my remarks, but those descriptions and summaries will be intentionally brief, as it's nearly impossible to convey or absorb a macro understanding of the human services budget while swimming in the detail of each program and its individual characteristics. Chairman Huntley's staff, as he mentioned, has arranged 24 hours of briefings over the next 2 weeks for members, and DHS staff will be coming to those and be happy to answer questions about that level of detail at those briefings. After my presentation, DHS's Director of Reports and Forecasts, George Hoffman, who's seated at my right, will build on the outline I've provided and give you an orientation to the process of forecasting in DHS's budget. As most of you know, much of the healthcare and human services budget is accounted for differently than most other budget areas in the state's budget. Understanding how those costs are represented and what factors influence them is fundamental to understanding and problem solving in the health and human services policy arena. DHS's long-standing mission is seen here. DHS, working with many others, helps people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. This is a monumental task, and it is the agency's job to figure out how to best meet this mission within the fiscal and statutory parameters set forth by the legislature each year. Public policymakers, including many of you and many of your colleagues in the Senate and the governor, and many of those who operate in the public policy arena, including many of the audience, are inevitably frustrated by the consequences that naturally follow from that mission. That consequence being, it's really complicated. Helping people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential does not come easy. It doesn't come with any easy financing or easy parameter setting or easy administration. The people seeking this help from the state's health and human services infrastructure come with mental illness and difficulty holding down a job that keeps their health insurance. They come with children that have been removed from their home and parents with criminal substance abuse records. They come needing help paying for immunizations and needing job training. This element of human need that takes endless shapes is much of what drives the complexity in this budget area. That's not to say that we can't do a lot to simplify the system with different public policy choices, more straightforward financing, and constantly striving for a more simplified client experience. But it does mean that our goals in human services have a lot to do with how much work is involved in running a system to meet them. With that said, let me get to the complexity. This is a chart of the state's budget broken down by funds. This represents all of the state's funds, not just the general fund obligations. As you can see, only 60% of the state's total budget is made up from the general fund. The Health and Human Services budget draws from primarily three of these funds, the general fund, the federal fund, and the other categories fund, which includes the Health Care Access Fund. The next chart shows the same all-funds view of the state spending, but it is broken down by each state agency spending. The Health and Human Services budget represents 37% of the state's all-funds spending, the largest of any policy area, followed secondly by K-12 at 25%. Most of you are more familiar with this chart's breakdown. This chart uses the same policy categories, but represents their share of state general fund spending only. You'll note that in this view, Health and Human Services spending is 31% of general fund spending, as compared to K-12's general fund's proportion of 38%. This has two important implications. The first is simply that looking at the general fund spending does not tell a complete story of the state's budget situation or how it's distributed. The second is that, in contrast to many other policy areas, the funding choices in Health and Human Services always involves the complication of assessing what federal money would be generated or lost as a result of general fund changes in human services. These are the 11 areas that constitute the fund breakdowns of DHS's budget. I'll cover these topics in the upcoming slides, so don't get worried about these particular 11 categories. The purpose of this slide is simply to outline for you that there is a taxonomy that the legislature and executive branches use to translate the legislature's funding decisions into the proper programmatic appropriations. This is a tool used to assist everyone in all roles and capacities in speaking the same language, but it is also an example of added complexity that must be managed in any given decision or proposal. DHS is one of the state's largest agencies. It has a wide variety of customers and business partners. In addition to DHS state staff and other agency staff that work on these programs, it relies on 87 counties, 11 tribal governments, 100,000 health care providers, and 9 contracted health plans to administer and execute its work. Administratively, DHS is broken down into these 5 business areas. The Finance and Management Operations area contains most of our administrative functions, including the work of licensing over 25,000 service providers. The Children and Family Services area contains all of our economic assistance, food support, and child protection activities. The Health Care area manages all of our basic health care programs and all of the operational pieces of running the fee-for-service program. The Continuing Care area manages all of our long-term care programs for the elderly population and people with disabilities. And the Chemical and Mental Health area manages our children and adult mental health policy areas, but also oversees 5,000 employees who do direct care work in state-run foster care facilities and smaller hospitals. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program, which is listed here as part of Chemical and Mental Health, is being transitioned out of this area and treated as a 6th independent area simply because of its unique and distinct charge. Narrowing our view from the state's budget to simply the DHS budget, this chart shows a breakdown of the funding streams used in the DHS budget. You'll see that Health and Human Services primarily relies on the general fund and federal funds, while the TANF fund, Health Care Access Fund, and special revenue funds are used in small portions. At milestones throughout session, for example, when the forecast is released, when the governor's budget is released, or when House omnibus bills are passed, the spreadsheets that fiscal analysts use will represent many changes, but you will oftentimes get a separate fund balance for each of these non-general fund accounts. Examples of those fund balances are included in your packets as attachments A2, A3, and A4.
Just for the members' information, that if you look at that chart, you'll see that about half of what we spend in this committee is federal money. So that roughly 50-50. So every time we cut a provider that's getting the money, they not only just to save our general fund balance, it costs that provider also $2 because they lose the federal money. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, we typically talk about that as one cut of a medical assistance dollar in a general fund means a $2 cut to the system as a whole. That's oftentimes the framework we use for that public policy discussion. Looking at just the Department of Human Services budget again, this chart shows a breakdown of all funds used in the Health and Human Services budget broken down by business area. You'll notice that the highest percent is spent in health care, meaning basic health care, while another 29% is spent in continuing care, meaning care for the elderly and people with disabilities. In addition to these two areas being the largest, they are also the areas with the highest growth trends. This is identical to the difficult policy situation at the federal level regarding entitlement spending in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. These facts make it impossible to manage long-term public budgets at the state or the federal government without, or at the state or federal government level, without tackling the hard questions inherently involved in healthcare public policy discussions. This slide shows agency FTE levels over the last 10 years. You'll note that in the early part of this window, the agency hovered just above 6,000 FTEs, the majority of whom serve in direct care capacities at state-run foster care facilities and small hospitals. DHS's FTEs peaked in fiscal year 08 at around 7,400, largely due to unforeseen and fast increases in the sex offender program population. With experience and better management tools, in addition to past admin reductions during this time and our current budget situation, DHS's FTE trend continues to decline. I'm now going to leave the macro Department of Human Services perspective and delve into each of the different business areas I've outlined already. I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch of the trends in each of them. I'll begin with the Children and Families Programs. Children and Economic Assistance Grants provide cash, food support, child care, housing assistance, job training, and work-related services to Minnesota families. This area is administered by Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson. Counties are heavily involved in the eligibility determination and administration of these programs. The funding for them tends to be a mixture of general fund dollars, federal TANF dollars, and federal food support dollars. Children and Economic Assistance Grants include the following. In forecasted grants, we include the Minnesota Family Investment Program and Diversionary Work Program grants, MFIP Child Care Grants, General Assistance Grants, and two housing-related grants, Minnesota Supplemental Housing and GRH grants. Other grants include support service grants, basic sliding fee child care grants, child care development grants, child care enforcement grants, children services grants, children and community services grants, children's mental health grants, and other grants that are small and miscellaneous. We're going to focus for our trend discussion today on the forecasted grant programs listed at the top. The three primary cash assistance programs include MFIP, DWP, and the Work Benefit Program, which is not yet up and running. MFIP provides cash and food benefits for families with children with income up to 115% of the Federal Poverty Guideline, otherwise known as FPG. Most parents with minor children are limited to 60 months of cash assistance. MFIP cash grants are funded with a mixture of federal grants and state general fund dollars, where general fund expenditures are partly determined by maintenance of effort requirements imposed on the state by the federal government. The Diversionary Work Program is a work-focused cash assistance program to help families avoid longer-term assistance. DWP grants are provided for 4 months. And the Work Benefit Program is to be implemented in October of 2009 and will provide a cash benefit of $75 per month for families exiting MFIP and meeting work requirements.
Just, again, for members, the maintenance of effort thing will be discussed, I assume, during this session, so there's a problem with the federal government on that?
Mr. Chair, there are lots of discussions about MOE, both federal MOE requirements and state MOE requirements, yes.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the the DWP, the Diversionary Work Program, I kind of remember from last session learning a little bit about why we do that in terms of being able to meet our targets with the federal government. Could you explain that? You don't look like you know what I'm talking about. Am I making sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative, The DWP program has been around for several years now, 4 or 5 years, and it actually was, the policy impetus behind it was actually to divert people from MSIP to help them find work faster on the front end of the MSIP program. You may be thinking about the work benefit program, the WBP program, which was instituted last year or the year before to better help us meet our federal targets to preserve our federal funding. Does that help?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I thought it had to do with the DWP also, though, but maybe I'm just remembering that incorrectly. But in any event, could you just explain that a little bit more, why that would the other program would help us? I mean, as I understood this, this was because the way the feds look at our success under the TANF, under the MFIP program, and this tries to divert some families from being part of that, part of the base, I guess, for that calculation. I'm sure you could explain this a lot better than I could.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's true that the way that we count for federal purposes whether a family is in our MFIP caseload or not, it matters if they're in DWP or not. And I would need to check with Assistant Commissioner Johnson if we actually don't count them while they're in DWP. That sounds right to me, but I'm not certain. We'd be happy to follow up with you during the briefing to explore that more deeply.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I would appreciate that just because I think it's important for us to understand that dynamic as we are looking at the budget, know how... I think it matters whether, you know, what we're doing with that program in terms of our total federal funding. Thank you.
Commissioner.
This chart represents the trend in expenditures in these three programs. MFIP and DWP expenditures decreased by an average of 3% per year from fiscal year 2002 to 2008, and expenditure trends are mainly driven in this area by caseload. This slide shows the trend in caseload in these programs in recent years. The MFIP-DWP caseload decreased by an average of 3% per year from fiscal year 2002 to 2008. And the caseload in these two programs, because the WBP program isn't up yet, the caseload trends are highly influenced by economic conditions. The forecasted increase in caseload in fiscal years 2009 to fiscal year 2011 is due to worsening economic conditions and the introduction of the work benefit program in October 2009.
Mr. Chair.
And lastly.
Representative Thiessen.
How much of the monthly caseload is the WBP? You said it's driven by those two things. How much is driven by one and how much by the other?
We can certainly get that for you. It's in the tails number in 10 and 11, and we can get you the exact figures. This last slide in the MFIP and DWP discussion shows the trend in caseload, in average monthly payments in these three programs. MFIP payments include federal food portions, which are subject to an annual cost of living adjustment. Average monthly payments decreased in this area at an average of 0.1% per year from fiscal year 2002 to 2008. The decrease in average payments in fiscal year 2004 and the increases in 2008 and 2009 are due mainly to legislative changes in how grants are determined. The forecasted drop in average payments in fiscal year 10 and 11 is due to the introduction of the Work Benefits Program. And the cash transitional standard, the maximum cash grant a family can receive, has not changed during this time period on the chart.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I wasn't here for the beginning. So are we going to, is the idea that we'll just note questions down here and then we'll have a chance to ask them when we have our informal meeting? Is that how you want to do it?
Well, if you need some clarification right now, that's fine to ask the question now. But you will have an opportunity in these separate meetings to get into more detail.
Okay, but I'll pass that for now. That's my thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, we'd be happy to have further deeper discussions with you during the briefings if that is of interest. this slide shows outlines the general assistance and emergency general assistance, CAS assistance programs, which are similar to the ones we've just covered, but for a different population, specifically the population of adults without children. GA provides CAS assistance for adults without children who are unable to participate long-term in the labor market. The general assistance single adults are eligible for monthly payments of up to $203 a month. And emergency general assistance is available for situations in which health or safety is threatened. It is not an ongoing payment. The trends in GA and EGA are seen here. This represents the trend in expenditures over the last 10 years. GA and EGA expenditures increased by an average of 10% per year from 2002 to 2008, and the increase in expenditures is due to a steady increase in caseload. This chart shows the GA-EGA caseload increase, showing an average of 10% per year from fiscal year 2002 to 2008. Caseloads are projected to continue increasing at this rate in fiscal year 2009 and increase at a lower rate in 2010 and 2011. GA and EGA average monthly payments are represented here, showing a decrease by an average of 0.2% per year from 2002 to 2008.
Commissioner, the GA and EGA are completely state programs, no federal money?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I also might add that they are very small programs, but they're represented here because they are forecasted. Moving on to the child care programs. Child care assistance programs are also managed in the children and families area. MCIP transition year child care, otherwise known as TY child care, is a part of the child care umbrella of programs. It provides child care subsidies for families receiving MCIP or who have recently transitioned off of MCIP. Another sub-program called the Basic Sliding Fee Program is a capped allocation which provides child care subsidies for families under 175% of poverty at program entry. Counties maintain waiting lists when they cannot fund all eligible applicants for this program. Families may continue to receive subsidies for basic sliding fee until they reach 250% of poverty. Families pay co-pays based on their income. And finally, the mixture of funding for this program is between federal grants and the state general fund. The trends for this program are represented here. CCAP, Child Care Assistance Program, expenditures decreased by an average of 1% per year from 2002 to 2008. Expenditures fell in fiscal year 2004 due to a decline in caseload and decreased average payments. In fiscal year 2008, 53% of expenditures were for MCIP transition year and 47% were for basic sliding fees. The CCAP caseload decreased by an average of 4% per year from 2002 to 2008. The caseload decrease in fiscal year 2004 is due primarily or partly to legislative changes in family and provider eligibility and benefits. In fiscal year 2008, 46% of the caseload was MCIP and 54% was basic sliding fee. And lastly, as the trend for child care, CCAP average monthly payments increased by an average of 3% per year for 2002 to 2008. Average payments are affected by market rates for child care. CCAP imposes maximum reimbursement rates by type of child care based on market surveys. And these maximum rates were frozen in fiscal year 2004 and have been allowed to rise in fiscal year 2006 and 2007.
Commissioner, on the previous slide, there's no increase in caseload? Projected or not a significant one, even though the economy is bad.
Mr. Chairman, George Hoffman, Department of Human Services. Part of the reason for that is that even though we are forecasting higher MCIP caseload, MCIP parents use a lot of this child care. And because of the bad economy, we're expecting less employment among MCIP parents, and so less use of the child care program. And if this includes basic sliding fee, I think we may be holding that flat at the base level too.
Thank you.
I'm now going to leave the children and families budget area and focus on the healthcare spending in DHS's budget. And as I noted earlier, that is the largest part of our DHS spending. I'm going to start with the trends in basic healthcare for multiple populations and work through our medical assistance, Minnesota Care, and GAMC programs. And I'll then move on to trends in our long-term care programs for people with disabilities and the elderly. Basic health care grants provide preventive and primary care health services for low-income families with children, elderly, and people with disabilities. The four primary programs are represented here: Minnesota Care, Medical Assistance Basic Health Care, Medical Assistance Basic Care for Elderly and Disabled, and General Assistance Medical Care. I think I might make just one comment. This is a complication in how we talk about this. When you look at agency-wide numbers of our spending in these two areas, we break out basic care spending for all populations. So populations across kids, families, elderly, and disabled. So we don't, in our budgeting, we don't show all of the costs that someone might be incurring across our programs. And that's just something to watch for. So someone receiving services, medical assistance services, who is elderly and on our waivered program and a basic care program, they'll be broken up in here. Some of their costs will be represented in our basic care discussion, and some of their costs will be represented in our long-term care discussion. So just know that the funding mechanisms don't align one-to-one with population breakdown.
An example of that would be, if I get to understand it, if someone's in a nursing home and they have to go to the hospital, then they're shifting from long-term care into an acute care system, which would...
Mr. Chair, that's exactly the point. In that scenario, that one person's nursing home costs will be represented in our numbers about long-term care costs, while their hospital stay will be represented in their basic care, the basic care numbers. We'll start with the enrollment trends for the elderly and disabled population, their basic care costs only. These numbers represent only the basic care costs, not their separate long-term care costs, including waiver or nursing home costs. Elderly enrollments increased by an average of 1.5% per year from 2002 to 2008. Elderly enrollment is driven by the number of elderly needing long-term care services, and 70% of elderly enrollees receive either nursing facility care or elderly waiver services. So the majority of this population is also using long-term care spending as well. Disabled enrollment increased by an average of 3.9% per year from 2002 to 2008. Disabled enrollment is driven largely by the number of federal and state disability determinations. The next slide shows elderly basic care average payments increased by an average of 11.3% per year from fiscal year 2002 to 2008. If we exclude the shift of elderly waiver costs into this activity, which was a public policy shift during this time period, the average increased cost is 5.8%. Disabled basic payments increased by an average of 6.6%.
Yeah, just, and do we have any sense of how that 5% increase compares to what happened in the private sector, like for private employers?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, this is always a difficult question to answer. The reality is that the private sector, the commercial sector, doesn't deal very much with this population, and so the comparison isn't a particularly easy one to make. The population that most closely tracks in the public sector with the private commercial population is our trends on kids and families. So working level families who have basic health care needs. This particular population, the elderly and disabled population, is primarily born in public programs, either state public programs or federally funded Medicare programs. So the the one-to-one correlation is difficult.
Okay, Mr. Chair, but just so it was a 5.3% annual increase over that period of time if you take out the shift of the elderly waiver?
5.8%.
5.8%.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Elderly, moving on to the next slide, elderly average payments per month increased by an average of 5.8% per year from fiscal year 02 to 08. Excluding elderly waiver costs, the average increase was 4.3%. The average increase in disabled average payment was 2.2% per year from 02 to 08. The effect of shifting pharmacy costs from the Medical Assistance Fund to the Medicare Part D federal fund is more obvious in the disabled trend rate here. The next set of slides shows the same trends in basic health care, but for families and kids, as opposed to elderly and disabled. This is a much more similar population to the commercial population. This category includes children under 21, pregnant women, and caretaker relatives of children under 21. Enrollment increased by an average of 5.6% from fiscal year 02 to 08, and projected enrollment rises sharply in the next 3 years, mainly because of the impact of a weak economy as more families lose employment and or medical coverage. About three-quarters of the expenditures in this segment, the family, MA Families with Kids Basic Care Payments slide, are for capitation payments. Expenditures increased by an average of 12.3% per year from fiscal year 02 to 03, or to 08, and about half of the increase came from increased enrollment.
Commissioner, I just see if I got this right. The elderly and disabled looks like it's maybe roughly 150,000 individuals. And that for the families and kids, it's going up to 450,000, so a considerably larger number of people.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. This is another fundamental in the human services realm, that the vast majority of costs in the system are the result of a very small segment of the people we serve. So the families and kids population takes up a large number of our caseload, but their average spending is very low. And that is a difficult thing to weigh as everyone makes budget decisions around how spending should be distributed.
Representative Anzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my question has to do with eligibility. In the blended health care programs where the partnership is between the federal government and the state, and then assuming we have county administration, where exactly does the eligibility rest? And is there discretion for the state in determining eligibility?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the state has discretion to determine eligibility levels within the federal Medicaid framework. A condition of receiving federal matching funds for our medical assistance program spending is that we operate this program in accordance with the federal framework. So there are rules at the federal level about who you must cover, who you can't cover, and the range of services you can offer and pay for, and the range of level of eligibility against the federal poverty level that you can cover. So it is, there's not an easy answer to your question. We have some discretion within that framework.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Anzel.
Just a suggestion. I realize it's not an easy question for a nice, simple, neat answer. But it seems to me it's going to be a pretty critical piece of information that we're going to need as we proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can certainly delve into that here and talk through what the actual requirements are. I'd also be happy to do that during one of the breakout sessions.
Fine. Thank you.
Okay. The MA Families with Kids Basic Average Payment slide shows an average increase of 6.3% per year over this time frame. The fiscal year 04 number is slightly higher than 05 because there was 13, it's just an anomaly in the data. There was a 13 months of payments in 1 year and 11 in the next. So otherwise, it's a fairly regular increasing trend line. I'm now going to talk some about MinnesotaCare moving away from the medical assistance program. MinnesotaCare provides subsidized health coverage for families with children and adults without children. Families with children are eligible with income up to 275% of the poverty guideline right now, and adults without children are eligible with income up to 200% of poverty. The MinnesotaCare enrollees pay a premium based on a sliding scale percentage of their family income. And one other important funding piece to understand about this is that the children and family members who are on MinnesotaCare are funded with joint general fund and federal matching dollars, while the single adults that we cover on MinnesotaCare are funded with all state dollars. The trends in MinnesotaCare are represented here. This shows an average annual growth in MinnesotaCare expenditures of 4.7% per year. Fiscal year 04 is higher because of the 13-month versus 11-month payment problem. Higher projected growth in expenditures is driven by increased projected enrollment. The next slide shows the enrollment trends in MinnesotaCare. MinnesotaCare enrollment has declined by an average of 3.1% per year during this time frame. Higher premiums, increased verification requirements, and until January 2008, a long application form contributed to that decline. Enrollment is expected to turn upward in the next few years due to the weak economy, transitional MinnesotaCare, which shifts some adults from GAMC to MinnesotaCare via a legislative decision, and transitional MA, which will shift some higher income children from MA to MinnesotaCare beginning in 2010.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Bronson, I'm just wondering, is there a way to put your finger on how many people within that increase are due to the reduction in the regulation or the reduction in the document itself? The argument we heard was that the document itself was so complex and so difficult, which I agree with, but it was so difficult that it was fencing people out of the process. And so I'm wondering if there's a way that you can put your finger on how clearing away that bureaucracy has opened the door to how many.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is difficult to put our finger exactly on what the change was. Whenever we look at trend data and try to sort out why something happened, we're limited to being able to look at the time period in which a change occurred and everything else that happened during that time period that could be contributing to a trend either upward or downward. So it's an art as opposed to a science. Do you have...
We expected a considerably stronger impact from the shorter application a year ago based on what looked like pretty good data on the length of application and the trends in the program, and it didn't pan out nearly as strongly as we had anticipated. But as the Deputy Commissioner has said, it's not really something you can get actual data on after the fact, because you would be guessing. And where where we thought families with children enrollment was going to go up dramatically, it didn't go up much at all. So this is part of the business of forecasting, that you think you know what's going to happen, but it isn't always so.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. I'll just limit it to two questions. Welcome back. Here we go again.
Thank you.
On page 17, you have the chart about expenditures, and looks like it's kind of, does that ever level off? And can you comment about where 012 winds up being on the expenditures for Minnesota Care, and what the fund balance is going to be? When does it hit zero? Or can you just comment about that? Then I have a second question.
Can you say slide 17?
Oh, page 17. The one you're, I don't know, slide 34.
Oh.
The one that's up on the chart now, up on the overhead. It looks like that's kind of going to keep on going up. Is that your trend? Does it stop at 012 and just flatten out? And when does the fund go through?
I'll let George answer.
Thank you.
Awesome.
The information about the fund is available in the Minnesota Care Fund Balance. We can get a copy of it. It's available publicly. Our forecast, I believe our forecast goes up following a similar trend in 12 and 13. And our forecast has been represented in the Minnesota Care Fund Balance. So we can get you that, or
okay.
We can get that to the chair.
I've got it at my right hand all of a sudden. Second question.
On A2. If you look at the fiscal year 13, it goes into deficit.
Thank you. And then second question is on the slide 36 about the payments. Since the provider payments are mostly flat, would that be more hospital use, or is there more utilization in that population to make it go up at that linear rate? Do you understand that question?
So Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, this is driven by annual rate. Since 95% of the coverage under this program is managed care, the trend in the payments is mostly driven by annual adjustments to the managed care rates. And so you get a fairly steady upward trend. It's also influenced by changing mix of people in the program. The adults without children are considerably more expensive than, say, the children. And so if the mix in the program is tending toward more a higher proportion of adults without kids, that also influences the average payment.
Representative.
Thank you. And then we added some single adults up to a percentage last time.
We expanded eligibility for adults without kids to 200 of SDG, and I believe it goes to 215 sometime in the near future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you covered all of my talking points for this slide, so we'll move on from slide 36. George has covered all of my material. So moving on to the General Assistance Medical Care Program. GAMC provides health coverage for non-disabled, non-elderly adults with no children under age 21 who meet certain qualifiers, such as being GA recipients or applicants for SSI. Enrollees with an income up to 75% of the federal poverty guideline are eligible, and enrollees between 75 and 175% of poverty are eligible for general assistance medical care hospital only, so catastrophic care if they need to, emergency hospital care. This is the basic health care program, safety net program, for people who are ineligible for the medical assistance programs we've already discussed. The trends in this program are listed here. Total GAMC expenditures increased by an average of 6.3% per year during this time frame. Program changes caused
the leveling off of growth in fiscal year 04 and 05 and again in 07 and 08. There's been considerable changes to this program and who's in it in the last several years.
Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you give us a little snapshot of a description of this population?
Mr. Chair, Representative George is very interested in answering that question.
A fundamental issue that is not well understood is that Medicaid has, or our medical assistance program has categorical eligibility. Some people think if you're poor enough, you will be eligible for medical assistance. And that's not true. You have to fit one of the categories of people covered by the Medicaid program. So you have to be age 65 or older. You have to be disabled according to the requirements of the Supplemental Security Income Program. Or you have to be a child. In Minnesota, we define a child as under 21. Some other states define it as under 19. This is an option under the federal Medicaid. Or you have to be a pregnant woman. Or a custodial parent of a child under 21. Those are the categories covered by the Medicaid program. And the people covered by the GAMC program are the non-elderly, non-disabled adults older than 21 who don't fit the Medicaid categories. And that's the reason the state adopted a general assistance medical care program to offer coverage to the people who were not categorically eligible for the medical assistance program.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I might just add the this population in and of itself, aside from whether or not you're eligible to be part of the population, is a very needy population. The income standard for this program is extremely low, 75% of poverty. The people who are in this population have lots of health care needs, lots of mental health conditions. The last numbers I looked at were 60% of the population had a mental health diagnosis. So it is a very complex and high utilization population. I'll also say one other thing about this program, aside from who it serves, is that it is coverage for people who are otherwise, who will otherwise enter the healthcare system as uncompensated care. So hospitals receive a lot of money from this program in payments as coverage for the people that they're seeing. But absent a program of this sort, both of those, it exacerbates both of those issues, both people not having coverage as well as providers, especially safety nets. Hospitals that see this population losing funding.
The percentage of money that goes to, say, out-of-office care is small compared to what's going to hospitals for this population. They show up and hospitals have to treat them by federal law if it's an emergency, and this is at least a way to help the hospital. Representative Godwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, how many states in the nation offer GAMC level coverage for this population?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know offhand. Because this isn't a national program, it's not something that's commonly tracked. Though certainly in the national public policy discussions about the uninsured rates and that sort of thing, there are scans, I'm sure, that perhaps capture that. It is not a common thing for a state to have a program like this. I would guess that if we were to do a national scan, it would be more common for states to have facility subsidies for safety net providers, hospitals, essentially.
that cover uncompensated care costs as opposed to coverage for this population. So there are different ways of addressing the situation, and not, I would say the majority of states do not have a coverage solution for covering those costs.
Yeah, I do know that Massachusetts, I don't think has a program like this, but they did have a very large uncompensated care fund that was spread around to particular hospitals to deal with the same population. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is a historical question, so maybe for Mr. Hoffman. Has medical assistance or Medicaid always been a categorical program from its inception? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following on the Chair's comment about this is money that goes to hospitals, I wanted to ask, we know that medical assistance pays payments to hospitals are less than what the hospitals feel they need to compensate them. In other words, they're having to make up those costs by shifting to private or to privately insured patients. With GAMC, is that the same thing? I mean, when we're talking about this money goes to hospitals, I just want to make clear, you know, this doesn't really cover their costs or what they would say their costs are, does it? I mean, isn't this just another, it's something, but it's not. I want to make clear that this isn't a gravy train for hospitals.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is true that GAMC rates are considerably lower than what hospitals would consider covering the cost of providing that care.
Continue.
For GAMC average monthly enrollees, we have seen that enrollment is about 6% lower in fiscal year 08 than it is in fiscal year 02. The enrollment history of the program is a lot dependent on legislative intervention. The rising trend up to fiscal year 03 levels, or fiscal year 03 levels off because of 03 session changes. And likewise, increases in 05 and 06 are followed by decreases produced by 05 session changes that were implemented in the fall of 06 that shifted many GAMC recipients into the Minnesota Care pool of eligible populations. Average payments in GAMC have increased by an average of 7.4% per year, with most of the increase occurring in the last three of those years. Much of this increase results from less costly new to GAMC enrollees being shifted to Minnesota Care that began in fall of 2006. And that left a more expensive residual population in GAMC. I'm now going to shift focus from the basic health care trend lines to the continuing care trend lines. Continuing care covers chronic health care services, long-term care in residential settings, at-home care, and social services for older Minnesotans and people with disabilities. This business area generally includes the following specific grants and activities. For forecasted programs, the medical assistance long-term care facilities, that's nursing home care, medical assistance long-term care waiver and home care, alternative care, and chemical dependency entitlement funds. The other grants are listed here, aging and adult services, deaf and hard of hearing, mental health. This is the portion of mental health that's grant-specific, and CD non-entitlement, as well as some other grants. For purposes of our trend discussion today, we'll focus on the forecasted programs at the first, under the first bullet. A major cost included in these trend numbers, as I mentioned, is the cost of long-term care facilities. Long-term care facility budget activity includes nursing facility care, ICFMR care. ICFMR is the institutional setting for people with developmental disabilities, and state facility care for mentally ill individuals aged 65 or over or under 21. This category is dominated by nursing facility recipient costs. Or recipients and costs. A second major cost included in these trend numbers is medical assistance funded long-term care waiver costs. Long-term care waivers are seen in the federal Medicaid framework as the alternative to facility care that we mentioned at the previous slide. In Minnesota, those waivers include the elderly waiver, which is an alternative to nursing home care, the DD waiver, which is an alternative to ICF care, the CADI waiver, which is an alternative to nursing facility care for recipients under age 65, the TAC waiver, which is an alternative to inpatient care for very high need people, and the TBI waiver, which is an alternative to either nursing facility or long-term care inpatient hospital care.
So, Commissioner, in all of these waiver programs, the people have to be already eligible for institutional care, like a nursing home?
Mr. Chair, they must be determined eligible for being at risk of institutionalization
being
in order to participate in these programs.
Yeah, what does that risk mean? They don't get those services, they will end up there?
Right. It's an assessment process that they have to go through in order to be determined eligible for here. It's an assessment of need.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why do we have this alphabet soup of programs? I mean, why, you know, maybe that's sort of a naive question, but, I, you know, why do we do it like this? Why don't we just have one program?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a combination of lots of public policy decisions over a long period of time that add up to lots and lots and lots of acronyms. I don't have a good answer. People have aimed for simplification for years, but simplification isn't easy to come by. There are federal frameworks to work within and funding streams at the state level to work within and lots of things that require special rules and things and lots of different interests to accommodate. So I don't have a better answer for you for that, but or than that. But
Mr. if you could go back one slide and I was just speaking of the acronyms,
yes.
Here they are. Why don't you explain what each one of those is?
Sure.
And even just what the word like DD means, developmentally disabled, so on.
Sure. On the slide 44, elderly waiver is oftentimes called EW, and it references this. The services that are provided as an alternative to nursing facility care. DD stands for developmentally disabled, and that can either be used to talk about a population as a whole or specifically our DD waiver, which is specifically for that population.
And then ICFMR.
ICFMR stands for Intermediate Care Facility for the mentally retarded with related conditions. It's an old term, but it was meant to represent the institutional setting for people with developmental disabilities. So we used to use the terminology mentally retarded and related conditions to represent that population. Now it's more common to call that population the developmentally disabled population. And there are a couple other terms of art to represent that population these days as well.
Why don't you go through the rest of them?
CADI?
A community alternative for disabled individuals.
CADI is... so CADI is... Thank you. CADI is the alternative to nursing facility care for people under age 65. And then the CAC waiver, community alternative...
For children.
Children.
I think they still are children, basically, who would be hospitalized if not for these services. This is a very small waiver in numbers of people. There are only a few hundred who are on this waiver, as opposed to thousands in, I think, all of the rest of the waivers.
Representative Anzup.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I assume
Well, first of all, waivered services are, I mean, we've been into waivered services for 25 years, or more. And I assume the impetus is to maximize federal financial participation. Therefore, can it be, can an argument be made that the more waivers, the better? And the more waivers, the better the opportunity is to draw down state financial participation for these target populations.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know if it's true to say that the impetus for creating waiver services was to draw down federal funds. The general understanding of what the reason was for creating these services was a policy position 15 and 20 years ago that said people should be served in the least restrictive setting, and that shouldn't be institutional care, which was where the majority of people served now on waivers were. And so as part of the deinstitutionalization trend about 20 years ago, waivered services were created as the way to pay for services for that population in the community rather than in an institutional setting. Now the costs are, there are lots of discussions now to have about the costs in these programs and who they're serving, because one of the challenges in writing the right public policy around these programs is that we know we have more people served on these waivers than were in institutions at any given time in history. And so there's an attractiveness about these services as opposed to an institutional setting service that creates interest and appeal for broader and broader populations to be served on the program. But that is kind of the current situation we're in. And now have many more people served on long-term care waivers and very few institutions anymore, which most people would agree is a public policy success based on the goals that were set 20 years ago.
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I was going to ask the cost question, but it sounds like that's, you've answered that a little bit, and it's pretty complex. I just had, as a new member, a question about who provides the services, and are they in a at-home setting a lot of these, or in a more group home, congregate setting, or how when we talk about deinstitutionalization, is that, I get the big brick building and the manor, but where else are those services being provided?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it could be in either. This funding stream, the waivered services funding, covers both small corporate foster care settings, where four or five people with disabilities might live together, and that would be their home, but there's staffing and that sort of thing around them. And it also pays for services that come into someone's home, their home living with their family, but receive services at their family home. So it's a mixture, and it's, the model is to assess what someone's needs are and figure out what services they need wherever they, their least restrictive preferred living site is. So it's a very person-centered approach to delivering services.
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, do we also leverage other funds, for instance, housing dollars for people who are living in those, say, group home settings? Would someone, say, be eligible for federal housing fund, Section 8 or something, and waiver services through DHS?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is a very difficult policy situation to be in. One of the difficult framework issues of the Medicaid program is a principle at the federal level that Congress feels very strongly about, that medical assistance shouldn't pay for housing. And historically, the institutional model of care was kind of the exception to that, because if you're in a nursing home, medical assistance is paying for your care and it's paying for your housing effect of that care. And likewise, in the ICFMR setting, the institutional setting, it was paying for your housing as well as all of the other care you need. So there's a real rub here from the federal perspective about how much medical assistance actually can or should be paying for when it comes to housing. And whichever way that debate goes, if the feds say we're going to tighten up and you can't use any of it for housing, the question about, well, where does housing support come from certainly remains. So this is an area that is difficult to wrestle through.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is more of a request for some information, and as we go through the information, and there's a lot here, and I really appreciate it, I'm wondering if we can take another cut at getting the information that goes across the different systems. So I'm wondering if we could get from the department a breakdown of the state and the federal share for all the DHS programs that we're talking about so we can see sort of how those things fit together. And I think it would be helpful for us to understand what the federal minimums are. Mm-hmm. And you referenced that a little bit, but if we could look at it globally or across, that would help me, and I bet others as well. And then if we could identify the programs that do have federal match and the ones that we don't. I know we already talked about JMC, but if we could look at it globally, I think it will help all of us sort of get a better perspective of what the tools are before us as we go forward this session. And I'd be really grateful if we could get that information.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I have an 85-state spreadsheet, which is just what you're asking.
Well, Mr. Chair. You know, if the only way to get information is in 85 pages, you know, I will pick through it and edit. And if there's a way to get a summary, that would be also very helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we will see what we can put together. I understand what you're aiming for. The ability, how easily that's accomplished or how well it can be represented in a simple format is... We'll put some people to work on thinking through that.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly
things
can...
Things are never easy, and if you look at the eligibility for Minnesota care by age of the child, if they're a 1 to 2, they're in one category. If they're 2 to 3, they're in another, and it's all due to the federal complexity. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, that spreadsheet, can we get that in electronic form? Is that like an Excel spreadsheet?
Absolutely.
All right.
It's on the reports and forecasts webpage too.
Oh, it's that one. Okay. All right. My question was, we talk a lot about the waivers and how we've kind of been moving and succeeded in moving from institutional to home and community-based care. Do you know where we rank in terms of per capita people still in institutions versus other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I don't recall our exact ranking, but we do well when compared to other states about how many people we serve in the community versus institutions. We can certainly look and see what staff have that someone has compiled about a national look at that.
Okay, thank you, because I've kind of heard mixed reports on that. I mean, we've kind of had this assumption that we're really good at it, but I've also heard people that say that assumption may not be entirely accurate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's true. There was a report that came out about 6 months ago that graded Minnesota quite low in this regard, and we've done a lot of work and analysis to dig through that and understand why that data looks so different,
Okay, Commissioner, TBI, even I know what that one is.
Traumatic brain injury is the last acronym on this page. And you can tell, just in my not being able to remember the words for CADI, these waivers are really called by their acronyms as opposed to their full spelled out names. They're shorthand and vernacular in the human services world. The other piece that is represented in these long-term care trend numbers are also personal care assistance services, private duty nursing, and home health care services. So that's the full universe of everything that you'll see in these numbers. This slide shows the recipient trends. The number of long-term care facility recipients has declined, and waiver recipients have declined by an average of 3.9% per year. And the continuation of that decline in, I'm sorry, long-term care trend, the red line that you're looking at, declined at 3.9% per year, and that continuation is expected to continue, or that decline is expected to continue. And then the number of waiver and home care recipients has increased by an average of 4.7% during this time period per year. And growth has been limited in certain cases where you see downward trends or flatlining because of waiver caseload caps that were in effect from fiscal year 04 to 07 and 09 to 11. Decreases in fiscal year 06 and 07 came from elderly waiver recipients shifting to managed care. Long-term care facility spending has decreased by an average of 1.9% because of declining numbers of recipients, and long-term care waiver and home care spending has increased by an average of 10.4% from 02 to 08. About 40% of this increase resulted from more recipients using waiver and home care services. On the average cost slide, average costs for long-term care facility recipients are driven mainly by changes in facility rates, including COLA increases. Average costs have increased by 2.1% per year. Average costs for long-term care waiver recipients are driven largely by COLA increases, as well as changes in individual packages of services and changes in the mix of more expensive and less expensive recipients.
Representative Hush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering why these graphs aren't also broken down into the home health care average costs. Because you have the average cost for long-term care facilities and then the average cost of them combined. Can you get us the breakdowns for what the waiver average cost is independent of anything else?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're looking for home care broken out or waivers broken out?
Well, the long-term care waiver and home health care waiver, the graph that you have right now. You have long-term care. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading this wrong. I'm reading long-term care facilities. I was thinking, never mind. It's my error. I apologize.
Okay.
Thank you for making me look at this folder.
I wanted to say just a couple other things. This is the conclusion of the large macro healthcare trends, but I wanted to mention just a couple other areas of DHS's budget, not to go into detail here, but to represent them as part of DHS's budget, so that, especially for those of you who are new, you know that there are slivers outside of the macro funding pieces. State-operated services refers to the services that the state runs as a provider. So places where we provide direct care to people with disabilities at campus-based regional treatment centers and state-operated programs and residences located within communities. This is important in a budget overview simply because the cost of this area of DHS's budget is primarily made up of employee costs, administrative costs. State-operated services is where 5,000 of DHS's employees are employed. They're doing direct care work throughout the state at these different facilities. And so the budget of state-operated services is very different than any of the trends we've looked at during the last hour or so. But it is an important part of DHS's budget. State-operated services provides mental health services in some cases, enterprise services, which are small slivers of services that run on their own revenues, and then the Minnesota Security Hospital and the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program. And then lastly, I just wanted to mention the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program, which I mentioned earlier is being segregated out as a separate business area inside DHS. MSOP provides direct care services at Moose Lake and St. Peter to individuals who've been committed by the courts as a sexual psychopathic personality or a sexually dangerous person. MSOP is a sex offender treatment program that operates in a secure environment. Safety, security, treatment, and programming are the primary goals of MSOP. and I've already covered the last bullet. The reason I raised this in a budget conversation is that the characteristics and considerations in the funding of the cost for this program are very different than anything else in the DHS budget. There's lots of relationship between this budget item and the way corrections does its budgeting and policy considerations. So I just put that on your radar screen to flesh out the rest of the agency's budget.
And don't they have a $16 million deficit right now?
In 2009?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, we do not have a deficit of that size in 2009.
But they just, we'll check on that. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Can you just talk a little bit, what are the enterprise services, what kind of services they provide, and what are the alternatives to those services outside of state-operated services, if there are any?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, these are very small-scale services, and they were created maybe a decade ago with the thought that they would operate as any private sector provider would, hence the enterprise title. So one example is our dental services. We have dental clinics that are operated by state staff that are vestiges of a lot of the dental service we did on the regional treatment center campuses. And we continue to provide services largely for really deep-end, difficult clients. So uncooperative patients or patients with really difficult to treat sorts of dental needs, we would provide services in that enterprise service at those locations. We also run a children's behavioral health unit under enterprise services, again, serving very deep-end kids with behavioral needs. The private sector comparison, again, is a difficult one here. One of the goals in the mental health arena has been to build up private sector capacity, and that has been a strong effort over the last 5 years as we've closed regional treatment centers on the mental health side of things. So that the private sector has certainly increased its capacity to deal with complex mental health patients. But there is the notion of a safety net service, which is why the state has continued to be kind of the provider of last resort in these cases.
And Mr. Chair, and that's kind of what my question is going to a little bit, is that, like for instance, in the dental services, I know that there are people that are served by these enterprise services that aren't served anywhere else because no other provider really has the capacity to provide the services to these people. And similar, I think, in the children's behavioral health, for instance, the having a place like a safety net where people can go where there aren't options to serve them in the private sector, I think that's an accurate description. And I guess the question I have then is if it is truly a safety net service, does an enterprise that's supposed to compete with things that don't exist in the private market because they're not sustainable in the private market, does that model make sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the idea was that they
I understand the idea. I'm just wondering if that makes sense after a decade of experimentation.
I think it's a mixed bag. In areas where there's coverage and revenue streams available to cover the cost of those services, then an enterprise model works. In cases where there aren't, then it kind of falls apart because there's not a revenue stream covering the cost of doing the service.
That's fair. Okay.
And, Commissioner, aren't some of these facilities the equivalent of ICF MRs? They have state employees in them?
Mr. Chair, they are not institutions by the ICF MR definition, but they are serving the same population that was served in ICF MRs. ICF MRs are larger. That's kind of the distinction. All of the sites in that DHS operates are smaller corporate foster care model services.
Representative Liebling's next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking back at slide 42, you had mentioned chemical dependency entitlement under the forecast program. And I was kind of waiting for that to be discussed and didn't hear anything about it. So I'm kind of wondering, where does that come up? What is that under the entitlement portion of chemical dependency services?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did not cover the chemical dependency entitlement largely for scale. It's smaller than a lot of our other programs, but we could certainly get you more information about that or discuss it at one of the briefings.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair and Commissioner, if you're going to do that, I'm really interested in how that also fits in with public safety budgets. So I don't know what the interaction is there, but certainly there's a lot of policy crossover. So I would appreciate if you're going to get some information for me about what Minnesota does with chemical dependency treatment to the extent you can, if you would kind of consider that, if some of it might be in other budgets.
Mr. Chair, Representative, is there something in particular that you're thinking of?
Well,
a lot of the costs here are borne at the county level. The county detox costs oftentimes come up in this debate, but is there something particular in public safety's budget?
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, just that I also sit on public safety finance, and, you know, as we're looking at where we can consolidate and where we can be more efficient, I'm just kind of wondering if there are duplications of services, if there are ways we can administer things better, that kind of thing. I don't have a particular thing that I'm looking for.
Yes, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, that concludes my portion of our presentation, but Mr. Hoffman is going to say a few things about the process of forecasting in DHS's budget, which is admittedly difficult and complex, but also sets the starting point for all of your work during the legislative session. So he's going to give you just a brief orientation about the fundamentals of forecasting.
Before he starts, we have a question from Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, just to follow up with Representative Leeming's comments about forecasting for chemical dependency, if indeed public safety decides to change policy and put more people, say, into some diversion program which may include treatment, have you thought about what that would do to your chemical dependency budget? So if there were more people that ultimately became eligible to receive chemical dependency treatment and that was part of a diversion to get more people out of the state, out of the corrections budget, have you thought about that? Is that a consideration when you forecast?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would think about it if a proposal like that were to come forward, to the extent that there was interaction between those two. So if some policy change in the public safety arena suggested that there was going to be more mandated CD treatment that would become a burden on this budget activity, that would be something that we would fiscal note jointly with the Department of Public Safety to make sure that the costs were accounted for.
Thank you. Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much time would you like me to take?
5 minutes.
10, 15?
15.
Okay, because I can go on as long as you'd like.
forget it.
I'm the director of the DHS Reports and Forecast Division. I have a staff of three economists who, with me, are the forecasting staff. Three of us work mostly on the healthcare program, and the fourth one works on MFIT, child care, general assistance. What we do is attempt to forecast the number of people who will be on our programs and what we will spend on them under the current law. And so we look at, we base our work, we use a lot of historical data, we base our work on what is expected to happen under the current law, including things that may not have been implemented yet but are in the law, or including things that say something happens to hospital rates at a certain date. If that's in the law, we aim to include it in the forecast. Other rate increases, fee-for-service rate increases, we don't assume in the forecast, and we don't assume COLA increases in the forecast unless they're in the law. If they're provided for in the law, we include them. The big exception is that because the department has authority to negotiate managed care rates, we assume rates will change annually, and so those increases are in the forecast. We do a month-by-month forecast. We use a lot of monthly data for many years going back, and we use mostly statistical methods to the extent we can to do a month-by-month forecast into the future. And at this point in the process, we are forecasting participation and expenditures in our programs out to June of 2013. And the reason for that is we need to cover the next biennium for which you are starting to work on the budget. That ends in June of 2011. And we also, in fiscal notes and in the forecast, forecast the biennium after that. And when we have proposed changes in law, we participate in the fiscal note process, and we do projections of the effect of program changes which are being considered by the legislature. And in that case, we try to give you information about how many people we think will be affected and what will be the effect on costs of the programs from that proposed change. And that again, we look at the period out to the end of fiscal year 2013, because we have a forecast for those years, and we also do fiscal notes on the same period, so that at end of session, the things that have passed, staff can use the fiscal note values, the estimated costs of those things, and they can adjust the base budget according to the fiscal notes on the things that have passed. Our current law forecast is used as a base for the budget. So it's the current law forecast plus the fiscal notes. That's where we get end of session forecasts forecasted program. Now, over the years, we always face the question of why are costs going up? Why are costs going up so much? And in particular, because a whole lot of the money in our programs is in the medical assistance program, why are the costs of the medical assistance program going up so much? Now, in a couple of the slides, you saw some history of enrollment of elderly and disabled people in the medical assistance program. I think 27, if we can go. Slide 27, you see that steady march of more people every year? That's one of the factors in why the cost of the medical assistance program is going up. You add that steady increase in the number of participants in the program and add some inflation of the cost of services, and when you add those two together, and especially add that a certain subset of these elderly and disabled enrollees are in expensive long-term care services, either in a facility or in a waiver, and we tend to get more people utilizing those services. Now, in the institutional setting, you can see, this is slide 46, you can see the number of people in LTC facilities has been slowly going down. And as a result of that, expenditures on those services have been fairly flat. But while that's been happening, the use of services has been rising in the alternatives, and that's where the growth is occurring. And so we get cost growth from more people using expensive services, and it may be elderly waiver recipients at a service cost of $1,100 a month. It may be DD waiver recipients at a cost of $4,500 a month. But those more use of those services drives up the cost of the program. And the services, of course, you got to allow some increase in the cost of services. There's also increase in the cost of services because of more people using 24-hour care. In the DD waiver and in the CADI waiver, there's a cost gap between people who are served in their own homes, where they may be served quite cheaply, and people who are in a setting where they need 24-hour supervision. That's more expensive. And as the mix changes to more people in the more expensive settings, that also contributes to driving up the average cost of service in the waiver and in the program. And so those are the basic reasons why the cost of the medical assistance program long term has tended to increase at something in the neighborhood of 10% a year. And that growth in the medical assistance program, also because it's 80% or so of our forecasted expenditures, that growth drives the whole general fund forecast to where you see a forecasted cost growth year over year of 9%, 10%, 11%. And so that's where it comes from. Now, when we talk biennial growth, I would urge you to remember that a biennial increase is 2 years worth of increase. So when we turn it into biennial increase, what is 9% or 10% a year turns into 18% or 20% biennium over biennium. So that's sort of basically what we do, and some description of the reasons for the underlying cost growth.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add one thing, I commented earlier to Representative Broad's question that forecasting is more of an art than a science, but George and his staff put a lot of discipline and experience behind the forecasting we do and the fiscal noting we do. So I just want to emphasize to you that there's a lot of rigor behind the thinking and estimating of costs that goes into all of the proposals that you forward and our estimation of the costs that will mean for the state budget. The goal of the forecasting function is to try to get it right what our actual costs are going to be. And George and his staff take that very seriously. I take it seriously as deputy at DHS that can result in some hard answers to public policy questions, but it is the ultimate, it's the right ultimate goal to have, that we're trying to get right what our fiscal future is when we're anticipating or planning for proposed changes. So. We've overwhelmed you.
Thank you. Any questions for the Commissioner or Mr. Hoffman? And there'll be a test on the acronyms tomorrow. And there's a lot more people here now that weren't here when we introduced ourselves. Just go around and do it again. Well, Representative Liebling is here, and Representative Pollock was not here, and Representative Powell was not here, and Representative Kiffmeyer was not here, and... oh, there she is. And John Walsh is our financial analyst for this committee, and he was not here, really. And Julie Bunn, Representative Bunn, Representative Peterson, Representative Murphy, Representative Salzy, and Representative Gottwald, and Danielle Lemire. Well, Lemire is with House Research. So with that, I'd like to thank the Commissioner and Mr. Hoffman for their presentation, and I think they did a very good job of a very complicated and hugely controversial issue this year, how we're going to balance the budget in a way that doesn't harm too many people. So thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.